Translation. I understand that you teach Kalapa Vyakarana. I have heard that your students are very expert in the word jugglery of this grammar. Purport. There are many schools of grammar in the Sanskrit language, the most famous of which are the systems of Panini and the Kalapa and Kalmudi grammars. There were different branches of grammatical knowledge, and a student of grammar was supposed to study them all in 12 years. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was famous as Nimai Pandit, taught grammar to his students, who became expert in dealing with the word jugglery of complicated grammar. Almost anyone expert in studying grammar interprets the Shastras in many ways by changing the root meanings of their words. A student of grammar can sometimes completely change the meaning of a sentence by juggling grammatical rules. Keshav Kashmiri indirectly taunted Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by implying that although he was a great teacher of grammar, such grammatical jugglery of root meanings did not require great expertise. This was a challenge to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because it was prearranged that Keshav Kashmiri would have to discuss the Shastras with Nimai Pandit, from the very beginning he wanted to bluff the Lord. Thus the Lord replied as follows. Hare Krishna. So, thank you for coming today to hear my words, which I hope will be helpful in some way. I'm not qualified to be sitting here. So, just a little bit about what's going on here. Lord Chaitanya is in his youth, his Kishore age. He started teaching when he was 11. Grammar, he used to, in the house of Mukunda Sanjay, and sometimes he would go down to the bank of the Ganges and sit there with his students. He had many, many students. He was already famous. Perhaps at this time he was 12 or 13. He'd already done his tour of East Bengal and come back. And so perhaps 13, something like that. And he was famous, and he had many students. People would come from far and wide to take lessons from him. So he's sitting there, surrounded by his many, and they're all pure devotees, all his associates who've come to participate in his pastimes. And there's descriptions of the scene given by Krishna, by Vrindavan Das Thakur. It was a clear night, full moon. The Ganges was flowing smoothly, and the Lord was so beautiful. He was sitting there. We can't imagine what he looks like. He's the supreme personality of Godhead. His complexion was golden. His face was beautiful. His nose, his eyes were all very fine and delicate. He was smiling, glancing, his eyes like lotus petals. And his teeth, when he smiled, were like rows of pearls. And his reddish lips were like the color of the rising sun as he lifted his lips. It was like everything was enchanting. To see the Lord was like to be struck by enchantment, by wonder, by amazement at this beautiful sight. His body was delicate. His hair had curly black hair framing his face. His dress was divine, golden dress. His neck was like a lion. It said he had a neck firm like a lion. His shoulders were like an elephant. His body was large. The Lord became very tall. He was 7 foot tall. He had long arms that came down to his knees. And his chest was bare. And the Brahmin thread, which was actually Lord Ananta Shesh, was adorning his chest. And he had an enchanting mark of tilak on his forehead. So all in all, he was a stunning sight. And Keshava Kashmiri, by the Lord's arrangement, arrived there at that at that time, just as the Lord was sitting and speaking to his students. So the first thing he did when he saw him was like, he just was wonderstruck. He was amazed. He just stood there. Is this Nimai Pandit? This wonderful sight, this wonderful vision of this personality. So he stood there for some minutes, just gazing at him. But actually, because he had come in a mood of challenge, he was also struck by fear at the same time. It's described by Vrindavan Das that if someone has an attitude of antagonism towards the Lord, he immediately feels fearful. Ishvara Swabhava Shakti E Matahoi Dekitai Matra Tane Swadasya Janmai. So fear entered his heart at that point without him really knowing why, because he didn't know who the Lord was. Keshav Kashmiri, this is all a pastime. He's Nimbarkacharya, the great Nimbarka. He appeared in the Nimbarka line, and he's to this day, he appears in their sampradaya as one of the acharyas. But actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has revealed that he was an incarnation. As Nimbarka had a vision of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya came to him and said that when I appear in Navadvipa, you will also come, and I will give you prema. So everyone was coming to see Lord Chaitanya to get prema. And this was Nimbarka taking, this is the one, no one's going to miss the chance because he's giving it away freely. So we have the same chance. So he felt this little bit of fear. And when I read that, I was reminded of a really nice little passage given by Rupa Goswami about Kamsa, who was also, of course, belligerent towards the Lord and wanted to challenge him. But it was also struck by fear because of his mood. The Lord reciprocates. Ye yata mang prapadyate tans tataiva bhajamiham. If you want to fight with him, that's fine. You know, he'll reciprocate, but you'll feel afraid and fearful, and there's only going to be one outcome of that challenge. So Kamsa's attitude was, you know, one of challenge. So Rupa Goswami describes how one day he was sitting in his palace just idly passing the time away, looking out of the window, and he was thinking, what harm can this boy do me? He has no power. And then as he sat down, messenger came just at that moment and told him all his friends had been killed by the boy. So he thought, what, the boy? I'll kill all my friends. So he began to think, well, maybe I should surrender to him. Maybe that would be the best thing. I'll go immediately. But how can a great warrior do that? I'm a great, powerful warrior. I'm not going to surrender to a boy. So he's thinking like this. But then he thought, well, why should I be afraid of him anyway? I still have so many wrestlers. Oh, big power. And he had these immensely powerful wrestlers. We know Chanur, Mustik, all these, Tal, Tocha, all these different powerful warriors. They'll take care of him in no time. But then he began to think a bit further. Well, the boy's certainly not ordinary, because he lifted Govardhan Hill on his left hand. A whole hill. I couldn't do that. Maybe he's, I don't know. And he's constantly feeling this terror in his heart, and he's thinking like this. So then he thought, well, I've got to do something. I'll just go to Vrindavan and inflict pains on all the residents of Vrindavan. Yes, this is the plan. I'll take care of everything. But then he thought, well, but the trouble is, I can't even go out of my house because my heart is trembling too much. I'm so fearful. So he was aware of this terror in his heart, like, because just because he's challenged Krishna, he's feeling that. So Keshav Kashmiri, he's feeling the same way, but he still approached the Lord. And then the Lord received him very respectfully, very gently, very kindly. Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, is a wonderful person. He's a very soft-hearted, very gentle person. To meet the Lord he's not, you know, he's God. You think, I'm God, you better know your place, you know. Don't cross me or you'll be finished. You know, a big, wrathful person that sometimes he's depicted in other traditions. It's like sitting there casting judgment on us and sending some to hell, and others are like, okay, you can come and sit next to me for a little while. You know, it's like, but no, he's actually a very kind, considerate, merciful person, full of all good qualities. So when he saw Keshav Kashmir, he said, come down, come, please, sit down. I'm so pleased to see you. This is such a privilege to meet a personality like you. So he put him at his ease straight away. Keshav Kashmir, he felt, he relaxed him. He'd actually been thinking prior to this how to deal with the situation so that he did not in any way upset him. Although Keshav Kashmir, he was coming there. He was surrounded. I mean, he was like so famous at that point, the Dig Vijay. He'd had a benediction from Goddess Sarasvati that everything he spoke would be perfectly composed. He could compose Sanskrit poetry just at the drop of a hat. And it was complex. It was wonderful. Later we hear Lord Chaitanya saying to him, as a kind of backhanded compliment, I thought, that your poetry is so amazing that no one can understand it unless you explain it yourself. So that's like, yes, you know, but actually it's like, what's the use of poetry like that? You know, no one's so cryptic that when you read it, it's like, what's that all about? You know, you have to ask him. But so he had this benediction from Goddess Sarasvati, and so the pundits everywhere were afraid of him, and everywhere he went, he'd been defeating everyone, and he'd amassed a big, huge number of followers, and they were all behind him and surrounding him. And he had elephants, horses, chariots. He himself was carried on a palanquin. So he was a very great pundit. And of course, for a great man to be suddenly humbled is worse than death. For one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. So the Lord didn't want to do that. He didn't want to do that to him. He could have done that, of course. He could have, you know, because generally the way things happened in those days, in that culture, there was, the culture was one of knowledge. Not like in our culture where we're sort of, you know, on the bodily platform, we like fighting, we like boxing and wrestling. And the challenge then was on the mental platform, intellectual, that they would have these debates. So there would be a whole thing, you know, set up. They would sit down, two scholars, two pundits would sit down, and there would be a moderator to make sure they were arguing in the right form. They weren't resorting to any crooked arguments, you know, jalpa. It's like, you know, the different forms of argument, that vitanda, where you're simply trying to defeat the other person, you don't care. You know, using tricky arguments. So they would have to argue on the basis of vada, where the idea is to achieve, come to the truth. What is the truth? By the strength of their logical arguments and quoting of Shastra. So that would take place, the two, and there'd be lots of people, thousands of people would come. This would be their entertainment, to hear these two sadhus, two pundits arguing, debating together. Lord Chaitanya would also do that. He defeated everyone in Nadia. All the big Bhattacharyas, all the big pundits were in complete awe of him, because they couldn't begin to challenge him. So the Lord, he didn't want that to happen. He didn't, you know, that could have, because the pundit had come with that in mind. And if no one wants to sit down and challenge me, then just give me a certificate that I've defeated everyone in Navadvip, Nadia, because that was the seat of learning in India. That was the place still today. The intellects are understood. That's where they come from, Bengal. So he thought, well, if I can get the certificate there, that's my name and fame truly established. No one will ever challenge me. So the Lord, he didn't want that to happen. So he'd been thinking, there must be a better way. Let me, you know, find some way. So he had arranged this rendezvous to occur in this way. Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. want to be like Roma Harshan here. Although I am like him. Okay, so in a secluded place with just a few of his disciples, this is where he meets him. Of course, by his own personal arrangement. Because the Lord, as I was saying, he's like an ocean of good qualities. I was just gentle qualities. I was just reading the third canto where Uddhava is speaking with Vidura. And he also is meditating on the Lord's qualities. At this point, he's in complete separation. Krishna's gone, and he's on his way to Bhadarik Ashram or wherever, and he meets Vidura, and he's saying how he remembered the Lord. Although, you know, Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead, all the demigods come and bow before him. Everyone in all the great personalities, Lord Brahma, bows his forehead at his feet. And yet he would take the humble position. He would go before King Ugrasena and say, "My Lord, I would like to submit the following for your kind consideration in a humble way." And when he met his parents, Vasudeva and Devaki, he apologized to them that I was not able to be with you, to help you in your time of need. Please excuse us for this inability, for this failure. So the Lord is a very humble person, very gentle. And of course, Uddhava, he speaks that famous verse, which is so dear to the devotees. Aho baki yang stana kala kutam jikang saya paya yadapya sattvi lebe gatim datruchitam tatanyam kambadayalung sharanang brajema. So this famous verse, he was recalling how the Lord had liberated Putana. Alas, how shall I take shelter of one more merciful than he who granted the position of a mother to the she-demon who came with her breast smeared with poison intending to kill him? But still, Dattri, he gave the position of a nurse in the Parakya Ras, not Parakya, a Vatsalya Ras, to live with him forever. So this verse epitomizes the Lord's merciful qualities. And in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's an incident described, and also by Vrindavan Das Thakur, how Pundarik Vijayanidhi was once met by Gadadhar Pandit and Mukunda Datta, and how Pundarik was incarnation of Radharani's father. He was Prima Nidhi, they a very advanced, highly advanced devotee. But externally, he was an enigma because he sometimes looked very as if he was an enjoyer. He was a very cultured and very high class, aristocratic person, very wealthy. And he once was sitting on a bed and being combing his hair, looking in a mirror. And Gadadhar had come to see him with Mukunda. So he was a bit shocked, you know, how can he, I mean, he's supposed to be a great devotee, but look at him, you know, he looks like a complete sense enjoyer. So Mukunda, who was there at the time, he had a very beautiful voice. Mukunda used to sing for the devotees, and his voice was so sweet, the devotees would be fainting in ecstasy. They would be, you know, overcome with waves of bliss just by hearing him, his singing of the Shastra, of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And so he began to say, he sang this verse, Aho Baki, you know, the verse describing Putana. And as soon as Pundarik Vijayanidhi heard that, he became overwhelmed with ecstasy. He fell from his bed. He lost control of his body. He was trembling. He was crying. And he was, repeating the words of the verse. And then he fell into a trance that lasted for hours, just remembering the Lord's merciful qualities. He was completely overcome. And another incident I was also recently hearing is about Ramdas, who is another great devotee. He's an associate of Lord Nityananda. And one day, Ram Dass and Lord Nityananda and other devotees were making their way to Puri to see Lord Chaitanya. And each of them, one by one, were being overcome by ecstatic emotions as they thought about the Lord. And Ram Dass remembered Krishna, and he was meditating on Krishna's beauty and his qualities, his gentleness. And struck with ecstatic emotion, he assumed a threefold bending form right in the middle of the road. He just stood there in the Tribhanga form for 1 hour without moving. Can you imagine? He was just overcome by ecstasy in thinking of Krishna. So it wouldn't be advisable these days. They'd take you away and you'd locked up. Because everything that Krishna does is good. He's all good. His qualities, everything, his pastimes, even when it seems otherwise to us, we can't understand it. We should meditate on his goodness in different instances, such as this, how he's dealing with Keshava Kashmiri. He actually only wants to increase our love and attraction for him. Why does he want to do that? You know, sometimes people say, oh, your God, he's a very conceited and self-centered person, because he just constantly says, worship me, offer your homage unto me, bow before me, offer everything to me, give yourself to me, surrender to me. Hold on, enough of this already. Wait, who is this person? You know, why he wants everything. He wants me to give him everything, do everything for him. But it sounds very conceited, and those who know nothing about him, they think like that. But actually, unless we're attracted to him, we must be attracted to Maya, to illusion. And what's the consequence of that? We suffer greatly. So, therefore, the Lord is acting in ways to increase our love. We're actually meant for that. We're parts of him. We're in our very purpose, our very raison d'etre is to serve the Lord in love. And when we do that, we feel peaceful, we feel satisfied, we feel happy, we feel blissful. So Krishna knows that. We don't know that. We think, oh, if I serve my senses, I'll be happy. If I, you know, act in selfish ways and do whatever I feel like doing, if it feels good, let me do it. But actually, what's the consequence? That we simply feel anxious, we're suffering, we're miserable. Prakriti stani karshati. We're grappling with the material energy. So the Lord, he wants to save us from that. And thus, he appears and he demonstrates these wonderful pastimes, these beautiful qualities. He displays them to us so that we'll become attracted and surrender. So Keshav Kashmiri, he was attracted, but at the same time was a little fearful. And he heard Krishna, he heard Lord Chaitanya speaking from Kalapa Vyakarana. So there are different, as Prabhupada explains in the purport, these different treaties of Sanskrit grammar. So why were they studying grammar? Because in the Vedic culture, another thing, Vedic culture is very elevated. It's very highly educated, informed. And they know that epistemologically that knowledge descends. That, you know, our paradigm in Western society is inductive knowledge, that inductive logic. No, we must experiment and figure it out and use our brain and, you know, inference and that kind of thing, experimentation, science. But in Vedic culture, they have no regard for that. That's like the bottom of the pile, pratyaksha, understanding things by empirical sense perception. So therefore, they know that knowledge descends and therefore it comes from Shastra. So therefore, there's this grammar, study of grammar in their culture, because Shastra can be variously interpreted. Taka pratishta, shutaya vibina, arguments are inconclusive. Shastras are many and they don't always agree with each other. Even the great sages, Nasaf, Rishi, Yasya, Matam, Nabina, they disagree with each other, arguing all the time. So they study grammar very carefully in order that they can unpick the Shastric statements and try to understand them properly. Actually, Sanskrit is such that it can be interpreted in different ways. Although it's the perfect language, it has to be understood very carefully. It's perfect because it's unchanging. It has something like 2,000 root words that form the basis of Sanskrit. And that's a fixed number, 2012, I think. That's never going to change. And these words, these roots, they describe the attributes of things. They're not like our language. We have English is formed of two classes, closed word cases and open word cases. So the closed word cases are like pronouns, prepositions, like, you know, him, his, that, their, the. And they're fixed number. But then there's the open word cases, nouns. Nouns can be added to, and all the time in English you're adding words as new things come up, like download, upload. You know, these words didn't exist years ago. But they just add them as the need arises. And you have to learn all these words. You need a dictionary. Otherwise you can't understand what someone's talking about. It's a difficult language to learn. But Sanskrit, on the other hand, it simply depends on the root words which describe the attributes of a thing. So you'll have like Himalaya. Himalaya means a place of snow. Hima, and or Meghalaya, the land of clouds, where the highest rainfall in the world occurs, in northeast of India. There's much more rain than has occurred in recently in America, where there 10 times more than that every year. And that's Meghalaya, because there's always clouds there. Vidyalaya. So if you want to invent a new word in Sanskrit, you don't have to invent it. You just take two of the dhatus, put them together to describe the attributes. So toilet, for example, Sochalaya, place where you, place of clean, where you become clean, you know. So Sochalaya, or whatever, yeah. Sochalaya. Thank you very much. Does that mean toilet?
Yes, it still means the same thing.
But you also need to understand the words in context, right? Otherwise, they can have different meanings. I think the dhatus have like lots of different meanings. A particular one dhatu will have lots of meanings. So the words can be given different understandings. I was reading how Keshari? It means saffron, right? Or orange. Kesaria. So that can mean lion, because he's orange. But if you see the word there, you might think, well, it means saffron, but so you have to have another word to qualify it, which is Gajari. Gajari means enemy of the elephant, right? So saffron can't be the elephant's enemy. Must be the lion. So in this way, anyway, I'm just saying this to point out how Sanskrit has to be interpreted accordingly, in the context with the word meanings and everything. Otherwise, so that's why there was these schools. That's why Lord Chaitanya was teaching grammar. You might think, why was he teaching grammar? Why was anyone teaching grammar? What's the value of that? Like in our culture, it's not very important. You might choose English as a subject, but if you do, you're not going to get a job. So you're not going to choose it. You know, you're going to choose engineering or, you know, some of those like meaningful things, science. But no, not in the Vedic culture, it's different. They understand things better than we do. Actually, I was reading another little episode to illustrate how the Sanskrit is variously interpreted. And this is also from Rupa Goswami. And he's talking about one day Krishna came to see Radha. And he came, he was bare-chested, so she said to him, "My dear Keshava, where is your vasa at present?" Is this the right word? Vasa? Dress? How do you pronounce it? Vasa. Vasta. Okay. So where is your dress? But Krishna took the meaning as residence, because the same word can mean where do you live. So then he said, "My dear captivated one, at the present moment, my residence is in your eyes. So Radharani said, oh, my dear cunning boy, I didn't ask you about your residence. I asked about your dress. So then Krishna took the meaning to mean fragrance, because the same word can mean fragrance, right? So he said, oh, my dear fortunate one, I have assumed this fragrance so I can be associated with your body. So Radharani's saying, oh, Krishna, you're too much. So then she asked him, where did you pass the night? So the word apparently is yaminyamushita. Yaminyamushita. When English people try to pronounce Sanskrit, it comes out very strange. That's why we sing these Sanskrit hymns in the morning sometimes. And who knows what we're saying as we worship the Lord, thinking that we're praying in Sanskrit. I know the famous example where one time they were singing Guru or something, and Prabhupada said, that means cow. Jai Guru Dev. Guru, yeah, Guru. And the Americans were pronouncing it like that, you know, so like they were singing to the spiritual master, all glories to the cow, you know, which is also okay, because cows are glorious. But I mean, you know, so actually, as a brief aside, I've bearing this in mind, I've actually composed the English, the Sanskrit songs in English that can be sung to the same meter and same tunes, so to help us understand what we're singing and get the right meaning and the right bhava when we sing. So anyway, yamin yamushita, whatever. Actually, yamin yam means at night. This is from the Nectar of Devotion, by the way, as was the previous passage. And ushita means pass. So Krishna, however, divided the word yamin yamushita into two separate words, namely yaminya and mushita. So it came out to mean that he was kidnapped by Yamini, or night. So then he replied to Radharani, oh, my dear Radharani, how can night kidnap me? So in this way, he was being very tricky, because Krishna is a genius, and and he's very funny. So he was, you know, twisting the meaning and changing the meaning of these words. And this is also what Lord Chaitanya was doing when Keshav Kashmiri came there. He was taking one passage, interpreting it in one way, presenting one argument, and then defeating it. And then taking that argument and defeating that. And in, you know, one way, the other way, constantly like this. So, when Keshava Kashmiri heard that, he was like, ha! This is nothing. Small timer, you know, Balya Shastra. This is the boys, Shastra, beginner's grammar, Prabhupada translates it. So that so that was his first introduction. Oh, I'm pleased to meet you. I hear that you're a teacher of beginner's grammar, and you're very expert in the word jugglery, of this Kalapa Vyakarana. This was an indirect challenge to him. It wasn't, you know, the big challenge, oh, well, let's go and sit down in the public square and have a debate. But he was, you know, putting him down in an indirect way. Because he was very proud of his learning, obviously, he would be, because he was very learned. But actually, Krishna, Lord Chaitanya was thinking how to destroy his pride. And he does that, why? Because that is his mercy. Pride is a big problem. It's actually nothing but an impediment to our own happiness. Why? Because when we're proud and we're trying to be the lords and the controllers and the people and the one whom everybody worships and looks up to and is impressed by us, by our intelligence, it doesn't make us happy. It puts us in anxiety. It's very difficult to sustain that. We're not that person. We're not Krishna. We're not God. It's not meant for us. When we try to attract that kind of attention meant for Krishna, we just become anxious and fearful. Krishna bhaktaranga gatabasam sava loka maheshram. It's meant for him. Suridang sava bhutanam gyatva mam shantim richati. And when we direct it all to him, when we direct the glory, we direct the praise, we direct the worship towards him, we become shunt him. We become peaceful. And so Krishna, he wants that. He wants us to be happy. He wants us to be peaceful. So he destroys our pride in whatever way it may take. And in this case, it was by defeating Keshav Kashmiri in a very nice way. Actually, you know, he, despite his great learning, he was actually a fool, Keshava. Why? Because he thought that he could become happy by conquering everyone at argument and logic and by being seen as this big pandit. So he thought, well, obviously he was thinking this would be the means of his happiness. But actually, Nunang Pramatak Kurute Vikama, he's, you know, one who thinks like that, Yarindriya Pritaya Aprinoti, one who thinks that sense pleasure, mental or physical sensual, will make you happy, is described by Lord Rishabha as being insane, as being mad, no matter how learned he may be externally, how much knowledge he may have. He's a fool. So Keshav, he was a fool, thinking like this. So the Lord thought, okay, let me try to overcome his false pride. Of course, came that, there came this famous exchange between him and Lord Chaitanya, in which he asked him, oh, you're very intelligent, please compose some verses glorifying Mother Ganga. And which he did. In no time at all, he produced 100 verses. And the Lord found faults with those which Keshava couldn't understand. Actually, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that he actually, at that point, he was really getting Saraswati's mercy. Before that, it wasn't really her mercy. That his ability to speak, to compose poetry, and, you know, his knowledge, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that was Dushta Saraswati. It wasn't really actual Saraswati's mercy. It was like the shadow. But the real mercy came when she confounded his intelligence, because she actually, his intelligence became bewildered, and he was unable to defeat the Lord and challenge him. And the Lord took one verse from the 100, pointed out the errors and flaws, and said, there are unlimited mistakes in your poetry, actually. And he was like, what? How can that be? That's impossible. You know, I've never done that before. What's going on? You know, what's happened? Why is Saraswati doing this to me? He couldn't understand what was going on. He was, so he said, no, and then the Lord was very kind. No, that's okay. Everyone makes mistakes. We're human. To err is human. It's no problem. I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. So why don't you compose some more poetry? So then they said, okay. But his mind went blank, completely blank. You ever had that happen? Perhaps when you stand up to give a speech in a wedding or something, and your mind goes blank. Or you sit down to give a class. So that happened. And he was unable to compose even one verse. So this was really the mercy of the goddess. And of course it led to him gaining a realization. She came to him in a dream and revealed who he was, who Lord Chaitanya was. So this is a very wonderful pastime. Of the Lord meeting with Keshav Kashmiri. So for 10 minutes now, I just wanted to mention briefly. Can you give me one of the books? I forgot. A book about my latest book. I asked Nandan if he would mind if I briefly mention this because it's just come out, and this is a retelling of Srimad Bhagavatam, and this is called Mysteries of Creation. It's the second canto retelling, following from Sages of Naimisharanya, and along with my good wife Chintamani Dham, we're trying to present each canto in a manner that makes it a little more easy to read. We're trying to unpack the verses of Srila Prabhupada. We're taking this directly from him, and also give a bit of the dramatic background of Srimad Bhagavatam, because, as you know, it's very succinct, very philosophical, and just touches, usually just touches very briefly on the context, on the background. So we're trying to present that, put it in the context and give the dramatic background and make it flow like a novel, for example. So with the second canto, that was something of a challenge. I don't know about you, but I know myself, whenever I've studied Bhagavatam, I've come to the second canto, I thought, oh, right, it's got to be, I've got to read it, because, well, we've got to go systematically through the Bhagavatam, but second canto, it's tough. You know, it's very philosophical, it's very profound, and technical. So, but one thing I discovered as I went more deeply into it is that it's amazing. It's very wonderful, and it's so significant in our spiritual lives. This is where we're introduced to Shukadeva Goswami, the great Shukadeva. He appears on the scene just at the end of the first canto, and now in the beginning of the second canto, he begins to address Parikit. Parikit has placed his questions before him just at the end of the first canto. Oh, great sage, what should one do as he approaches the end of his life? You know, and what is the duty of all men at all times, and especially one who's approaching death? So this is the only question we should be asking. And our entire life should be dedicated to answering that question. That's the only business of human life. So it begins here with a Shukadeva Goswami. But it's curious, because immediately the first thing he does is he immediately destroys the materialistic paradigm. Shratavyadini Rajendra Ninam Shanti Sahasra Apasyatam Atmatatvam Griheshu Grihamedinam. You know, that those who are foolish don't ask this question. People who are Grihamedina, they don't ask this question. They have thousands of things to talk about. They can go on forever and ever discussing, you know, days and days and conferences and meetings and discussions, and they'll never ever even go near talking about this subject. Why? Because they're simply totally attached to their sense enjoyment. Nidraya, nidraya hirate naktam, vyabhayena chavabhayam, diva chataheyam rajam, kutumba baranenava, because they're absorbed in sex life, in enjoying, in collecting money. I heard this one class where Prabhupada was lecturing on this verse, and diva charte haya, where is money? Where is money? Their whole thing is like, how can I get money? This is their life. And they never inquire. Deha patya kalatra deshu atma sainyeshu asatsvapi teshang pramatak nidhanam pashana pina pashti. They simply, although they see that everyone is proceeding hastily towards the end of their life and dying, and they're heading towards the same cliff, it never occurs to them that they should do something about it. You know. So this is the first thing that Shukadeva immediately destroys, the whole materialistic paradigm. And then he gives this solution. At once he gives a solution. Tasmad Bharata Sarvatma Bhagavan Ishvaro Hari Shrutabhya Kirtitabhyascha Smartavya Chichatabhayam. So that one, we should simply hear and chant about Krishna. Etavan Sankhya Yoga, you know, the greatest thing you can achieve at the end of your life is Ante Narayana Smriti, to remember Narayan. Eta Nivrityamananam Ichitamakutobayam Yoganam Nipraninitam Hare Namanukirtanam. So one might wonder, okay, he's given the answer that the doubtless and fearless way of success for all, for everyone, no matter what your desires are, whether you desire all material success, liberation, or to go back to Godhead if you're smart enough, Harena Manukirtanam. This is the process to hear and chant about Krishna. So why then, having, that's it. So Prickett should have, well, hand me my bead bag. I'm off. I'm just going to chant, you know. But no, from that point, the entire Bhagavatam unfolds. And we find Prickett asking so many questions. They begin here in the second canto. You know, we find, what do we have in the second canto? Parikit, in chapter 8, many, many questions are given, which form the basis of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. So, We're trying to understand why it is that Parikit asks all these questions. If he already knows the answer, he's got his solution. This is a solution for everyone. No matter who you are, whether you're a yogi, whether you're a jnani, whether you're a karmi, chant the holy name. So fine. Actually, Prabhupada says in the first canto, in the 19th chapter, text 25, it appears upon the inquiry of Maharaj Parikit that the great sages were not unanimous in their decision as to what has to be done. After Parikit asked his questions to all the sages before Shukadeva arrived, they were wrangling. They couldn't agree. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that some of them were impersonalists. Some of them were Karmakandis. You know, they were different. That some of them like were the Vaisheshika school, where they think everything reduces to atoms. Or the Nyayas, they were into wrangling with logic, you know, neti-neti. Or the Sankhyas, they're neti-neti, like that, Sankhyite. So the Sat Darshans were represented in full among the sages. So Parikit saw this, you know, he could understand. So why was he asking? Because he was thinking, okay, you know, here is an opportunity. Here is Shukadeva Goswami. Very rarely does this personality appear in human society. You never see personalities like Shukadeva. When do they come? He came because here was Parikit. He knew Parikit was a great devotee of the Lord, about to give up his body. So he came there to speak Srimad Bhagavatam. But he wouldn't come and speak it to you or I. You know, he speaks it to those who are highly elevated, who are qualified to hear. And this was Parikit. So Parikit, let me take advantage of the presence of the great sage now and to clarify all these confusions and clear up all these doubts. And in the first chapter of the second canto there, in the purport of text 22, where the question comes from Parikit Rajovacha, after Shukadeva has described how one should think of the Lord, meditate on the Lord's form. So Parikit's aware, well, some people can't do that because they don't accept the Lord has a form, and they won't, you know, they hate the idea. Prabhupada writes in the purport of text 22 that they're revolted by the idea of the Lord's form, personal form. Parikit, being aware of that and having heard all these different bogus siddhantas, these different ideas being presented by the sages, asked the question. And Prabhupada says, Maharaj Parikit was already directly connected with the personal feature of the Lord Sri Krishna. And as such, he had no need to inquire from Shukadeva Goswami about where and how to apply the mind in the impersonal Virat Rupa of the Lord. But he inquired after a detailed description of the matter for the benefit of others who are unable to conceive of the transcendental personal feature of the Lord as the form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So this is where it begins. That, you know, the Bhagavatam is taking us to that form. Ultimately, the 10th canto, the form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss, the very sweet form of the Lord, is revealed in the 10th canto, the Lord's smiling face, the Ashraya. But the other cantos are required to gradually take us there step by step, to isolate the transcendence, to remove all of the misconceptions that we have. Because we have them. Because this is one thing also we discover when we read the second canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada's making it clear. You might think, well, Virat Rupa meditation, that's not for me. That's for those impersonalists out there, those crazy guys who are revolted by the personal form of the Lord. I'm not revolted by the Lord's personal form. I love the Lord's personal form. Well, maybe we do, but then again, maybe we don't. Maybe if we're honest and we look at ourselves and we ask ourselves deep searching questions, honest questions, am I attracted to Krishna? Really? You know, would I rather hear Srimad Bhagavatam than watch Manchester United playing football? You know, if I'm thoroughly honest with myself, how do I relax and spend my time? You know, would I rather go out with my friends and have a good time, you know, shooting the breeze, killing time, watch a movie, Or am I attracted to Krishna? Or is that my medicine that I'm forcing myself to do because I know I have to do it, because if I don't do it, ultimately I'll suffer and I don't want to suffer. And that's intelligent, very, very good. But, you know, the attraction may not be there for that sweet, transcendental form of the Lord to hear about him. Because we're envious. As I was saying earlier, you know, the Lord is the epitome of everything. He's the person to whom all glory goes, to all praise, all, you know, he is the one who is, it describes Lord Chaitanya with his students. He was entertaining them with his sparkling wit. Well, wait a minute, I want to entertain people with my sparkling wit. Listen to, what about me? You know, he was cracking the jokes. Everyone was laughing at his jokes. Everyone was looking at him. Everyone was being dazzled by his brilliance. I want to know what people do, dazzled by my brilliance, by my intelligence, by me, by my beauty. You know, we want people to, so that's our problem. We want, you know, to usurp Krishna's position, to be the one, to be him. And thus, the envy is there in our heart. So to tackle that, we have to awaken our attraction for the Lord again. And that takes time. You can't suddenly do that. You can't pretend to have that attraction. We have to go through the hard miles of purification, of actually step by step progressing through Srimad Bhagavatam. And it begins in the first canto, of course, but the second canto is also, we shouldn't underestimate the value and importance of this particular canto. Like the Virat Rupa, I was saying, you may think, well, that's got nothing to do with me. But has it? Because that's the Lord's universal form. Okay, in the second canto, it's described in terms of the planetary systems and other things which perhaps were culturally relevant to the sages at that time. They were trying to meditate. They would sit down and meditate on the universe and on the Lord's universal form, and they would try to meditate on the impersonal Brahman. They come to the point of negating everything, and there's a subtle form of the universe, the Hiranyagarbha. Try and meditate on that. So that would be relevant for them. But, you know, we have a different context now. But we can also meditate on the Lord's universal form. And because that means seeing Krishna everywhere and in everything. And actually, Prabhupada writes in the second canto, first chapter, 20th verse, about pantheism. Pantheism means this meditating on the Lord, seeing him everywhere, seeing everything as God. Pantheism in its higher status does not permit the student to form an impersonal conception of the absolute truth, but it extends the conception of the absolute truth into the field of the so-called material energy. Everything created by the material energy can be dovetailed with the absolute by an attitude of service, which is the essential part of the living energy. The pure devotee of the Lord knows the art of converting everything into its spiritual existence by this service attitude, and only in that devotional way can the theory of pantheism be perfected. So, in other words, he's saying that, you know, we also can apply this knowledge, this science, this technology given in the Bhagavatam in our Krishna consciousness. And why should we? Because we too are impersonalists at heart. We still have that problem. We're still turning away from God. Krishna Bahya Mukha. Our heads are still turning away. We don't want to see the Lord. So we must recognize that, you know, the Sad Darshan, sure, there's schools of thought, and we're not one of those. Thankfully, we've had the association of Prabhupada, and we're not going to subscribe to that ostensibly, externally. But in our hearts are still subscribing to it, to each of these impersonal philosophies, karma kanda, the desire for material gain, name, fame, and adoration, is all part of that. Sankhya, the desire for liberation. Oh, I don't like suffering. I want to be free of suffering. That's Sankhya, that's impersonalism. Jnana, that's the contamination of Jnana. So these things are all there. And so the second canto is tackling that and beginning to convert that into Krishna consciousness. So we've tried to bring out these meanings in our book, you know, really trying to extract from Prabhupada's purports the relevance to us in our spiritual life, in a humble way. It's not a very thick book, but, you know, hopefully you'll find something helpful in that respect, because we've linked it, every verse, we've numbered them in the text, so that you can refer straight back to Prabhupada and try to understand, you know, the connection and see. Because all we're really trying to do is to get people to take up Prabhupada's books and study them. So many people have them sitting on their shelf very nicely, and they look very nice sitting there on the shelf. But, you know, they don't actually take them off and read them. Because there's no time, especially increasingly now. We've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram, we've got Snapchat, we've got this one, that one. And they're just absorbing our time and just taking us, sucking our life energy, killing us, actually. You know, it's deadly. It's like once there was TV. TV was bad enough. And that was a problem. But it's just one thing, and you knew it was the enemy, and you could just turn it off. Or I won't even have it. I'll get it out of the house. But now we have insidious attacks in our phone, on our iPad, on our computer. You know, Kali has ramped it up. You know, he's raised his game now. And we're like challenged on every side. So the books are there. Are we reading them? Why don't we read them? Because we don't see the relevance. We don't see the importance. We don't realize that, you know, this is the solution. And this is what will make me happy. Nothing else can actually do that. So all we're trying to accomplish is that, to get you to really, to get us, ourselves, because it's having that effect on me, you know, by associating with Prabhupada in that way, it's realizing, wow, this is amazing. This is so important. Why haven't I been spending my whole life reading this book? You know, what have I been doing with my life? Why have I been wasting my time? You know, and I still waste my time. So let's not waste our time. And here's the second canto, I mean, it's not this book, but Prabhupada's book, and I'm hoping this will help you realize that and get more into it and perhaps understand it a bit better. So much nectar is there. You know, this Ashtanga Yoga is described, and the importance and relevance of that, how that fits in with our program. Then, of course, Bhakti. Parikit's questions. And then there's this astonishing conversation between Brahma and Narad. So Brahma is like the... Who's Brahma? Brahma's the creator of the universe. He's the most intelligent person in the universe. His body is comprised of pure intelligence. So you have an opportunity to associate with this personality. And with Narad Muni. Narad is Devarshi, the sage among the gods. And they're conversing. How would you be able to hear a conversation like that taking place, who knows where, in the heavenly planets, you know? So we've got this, we're privy to that. So to understand that is not easy. We have to apply ourselves deeply. And actually, you know, we must understand each canto successively, progressively, systematically. If we want to get to the 10th canto and get the benefit of the 10th canto. And Prabhupada is giving us that opportunity. He's presenting, he's unpacking each of these chapters brilliantly, incredibly. It's so amazing. And when you associate with that deeply, you begin to feel how the transformation takes place. And then, of course, in the 9th chapter are the seed verses of the Bhagavatam, which Lord Narayan spoke to Brahma. Of course, we've got Brahma's vision of Narayan. That's also there. That's incredible. Every part of it is incredible and mind-blowing. So, and the 4 seed verses, you know, from out of which everything comes, and that we've tried to show that. And Prabhupada writes, to be fully engaged in hearing the transcendental narration described in the text of Srimad Bhagavatam means to constantly associate with the Supreme Soul, Sri Krishna. And to constantly associate with the Supreme Lord Krishna means to be liberated from the qualities of matter. So simply, while we're associating with Prabhupada, while we're studying his books, hearing his books, we're liberated from the association of matter. So that's our goal, to be attracted to the point where 24 hours a day we're simply hearing and chanting about the Lord. So I better stop now. It's 9:00. I don't know if anyone has any quick questions before we wrap things up. Any points that you'd like to raise?